Broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin, devoted exclusively to educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Guida Brown, former executive director of the Hope Council, Dr. Steve Brown, retired professor of educational leadership and school law, Dr. Karen Sconsert, chair of the education department and associate professor at Carthage College, Dr. Jonathan Shaler, professor of communications at UW-Parkside, and Stephanie Skilba, vice president for community and government relations at Gateway Technical College. And now, here's today's moderator for Education Matters.
Hello, this is Jonathan Shaler for Education Matters here on WGTD Radio. I'm excited to present a host of folks from UW-Parkside who have been a part of the UW System Research in the Rotunda, which took place on March 6th of this year. And it's a celebration of the accomplishments, hard work, and creativity across a wide range of disciplines organized by UW System for undergraduate students who have been doing research in a wide range of areas. And this significant and impactful research is done by students from all campuses, not just the Research One campuses, Madison and Milwaukee. Parkside this year was very well represented with 7 presenters, 6 directly representing UW-Parkside, and 1 the Freshwater Collaborative, which I hope to learn a little bit more about from our coordinator, biology professor David Higgs, who is with us today, along with 3 students who I will introduce as we move along. So welcome, everyone. And David, do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself and how UW-Parkside became involved in this research in the Rotunda?
Yeah, thanks, Jonathan. We appreciate the offer to talk about this annual event, and I think it's an impactful one, as you mentioned before, for undergrad students. And it's one that's been going. The University of Wisconsin System has been running this for 20 different years. There was a break in 2021 due to COVID, but it began in 2004. And as you mentioned, its intention is to really emphasize the research and the creative activities, hard work, dedication that goes into research by undergraduate students. And oftentimes that's a group of researchers that sometimes gets ignored. Obviously, usually the big R1 institutes, which are great research institutes, but sometimes that's the focus. And so again, 20 years ago, within the UW system, there was a group of individuals that wanted to kind of celebrate what the undergrads are doing, but also on all campuses. So as you mentioned, the event happened back on Wednesday, March 6th, and there was like 160 total undergrad students from across the state. Parkside had 16 students that were presenting the 7 different presentations, and they're called posters. And some are familiar with that. That's a very common format to present the research, in which they're like 4-foot by 4-foot posters that a little larger font so you can read them from 8-10 feet away. So they're not like tiny font. And the purpose is to really emphasize, you know, the research, give some background, process, methods, data, but also then what's the conclusion? And then what's the impact it has for their individual research? And again, the UW system has been very active in undergraduate research, supporting it in lots of venues, and this is one of the venues. Actually, initially, it started out of something called Posters in the Rotunda, but that name is vague enough that I think the intention was to change the name, and that changed, I think, in 2017 to Research in the Rotunda, just to emphasize that. So, and I would say UW-Parkside has, although we're one of the smaller campuses, has had a really strong and long history of emphasizing undergraduate students involved in research, again, creative activities.
Fantastic. And you are the coordinator. What motivated you to get involved in organizing this activity?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I started kind of coordinating what's happening at the campus level for students to go to present at statewide and national meetings, emphasizing the undergrad research part of it back in, I think it was 2000. So I started here in 1999, been here a while. And again, Parkside's had a long history of doing this. I think for me, what really emphasizes when I was an undergrad many, many years ago, undergrad research I did then, which was more kind of piecemeal doing it, had a huge impact on my trajectory, career trajectory, my interest and stuff. And so I saw that impact. And I also saw the impact when I was doing graduate school and postdocing, when undergrad students were involved and I was working with students, undergrad students at that point, the impact it had. And it's clear to me, when students get involved in the undergrad research or in other disciplines, it may be the creative activities, the scholarship, it's all kind of this umbrella concepts. That's where I see when students go from being somebody that studies a discipline or a field to being someone that is an expert or professional in that field. Mm. And I think those experiences for many students can be truly transformational. And oftentimes it can either encourage their career trajectory or maybe it changes it. They may, once you get started in research, it gets under your skin sometimes in a good way, where you start getting really excited about it. And so I've seen that happen so many times. That's what motivates me. And as a coordinator, you know, I do have students in my lab doing research, but it's really organizing students to attend these different events at the state level. Parkside has its own specific event, as well as at the national level. There's something called the National Conference for Undergrad Research. And of these seven presentations at the Research and Rotunda this year, five of those include students that will be going to Long Beach, California on April 8th through the 10th. To present at something called the National Conference on Undergrad Research. And
fantastic.
And, yeah, last year, Elise, one of our student guests here today, went to that. Abby, one of the other student guests, she's going this year as well. So
that's wonderful. Oh, thank you for that background. It's really got me thinking about the value of this in a number of ways. It's also, isn't it, about networking and developing communication skills in terms of being able to talk about your field to a wide audience.
Absolutely.
The reason I bring that up is it's certainly germane to what we're doing here right now, right? This is a general audience broadcast to the state of Wisconsin and beyond regarding the research that's been done. And I think of in this day and age, perhaps always, but certainly in 2024, it's been important for our scientists to be able to communicate with the general public so that we know what's going on, we understand the significance, and we can act on that in intelligent ways. There's something called the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science at Stony Brook University, which is part of that effort. And so,
I think you raise a really important point. And this comes back to, what is the goal of this Research in the Rotunda event? And you hit it on the head, that is, it's a matter of communicating the research. And it's not so much on the minutiae and the detailed procedures, but the impacts and the importance of it. And really the target audience at the Research in the Rotunda event are, frankly, the legislators. And so all the legislators, senators, state representatives are invited. All the students, when they register, they indicate what is their legislative district. And then the UW system, you know, puts an invite out to all of those senators and representatives. And so many of them, not all, but many of them will attend, and they'll go around and talk to students, during this event. For example, this year, Governor Evers, and that's the first time I've seen a sitting governor attend this event in the 20 years that I've been going, at least. And so that's part of the audience. But also virtually all of the chancellors and all the universities and the provost attend. You have the UW system president, Rothman, presented a short presentation at the lunch event. And then also you have many of the Board of Regents. So the audience is, as you pointed out, it's the impact of the research, but on a broader audience. Well, hopefully it'll have an impact on those legislators to continue to support it, as well as the UW system and the efforts in undergrad research.
Mm. And the physical layout, this is literally in the rotunda of the Wisconsin State Capitol?
Yeah.
On the floor exclusively?
Yeah, so if you go to the second level, you have that area that has the balcony or the railing and the opening down to the main floor, but that's where all the posters are set up. It's a pretty crowded event. Okay. Because again, there's like 98 posters in this relatively small space. lots of people. You're looking at, I'm not sure what the number of people, it's got to be in the order of 300 to 500 people. And it's kind of an echoey space, but it adds an excitement to it. So absolutely, it sits literally in the rotunda, thus the name Research in the Rotunda.
Oh, fantastic. Well, let's talk to some of our student presenters. I'm thrilled to have three of them with us here today. Let's start with Abby Lentz of Waterford, Wisconsin, UW Parkside student who had a presentation on monitoring bumblebee populations on UW Parkside's campus. Welcome, Abby.
Hello, yeah.
Could you tell us a little bit about yourself before we get into the actual study?
Yeah, so my name's Abby Lentz, and I'm currently a senior at Parkside. I've been participating in the research project that I'm on for about 2.5 years now. So I've had a little bit of time doing that. And then after graduation, I am looking to get my master's in public health at UWM in environmental health sciences. So I'm sort of going to continue along with my research.
Fantastic. And what has this experience been like working on this bumblebee research? Who was your professor?
So the professor that I work with, her name is Dr. Jessica Orlovsky, and I've also had her for many classes. Like, I took biostatistics with her. I've taken ecology and parasitology with her. So I've been able to do a lot of work with her. It's been really great.
Wonderful. And there were other students involved as well, yes?
There are, yeah. So I've actually, the first year that we did this project, it was just three of us. So a couple of my peers, it was me, a girl named Natalie Meyer and Nicholas Winter. And then just this most recent year, we had a couple of more students join us, Hannah Paulman and Haley Fee.
Okay, great. So tell us about the study.
Yeah, so just the objective of this project is to monitor resident bumblebee populations on University of Wisconsin Parkside's campus. And this was really inspired by the fact that UW Parkside is within the known range of a federally endangered bumblebee, which is the rusty patch bumblebee. And also just that bumblebees contribute largely to healthy ecosystems. Yeah. Okay. And then, so this was really, it was really kickstarted by, there were sightings of the endangered bumblebee on the campus. And this really inspired a company known as Brookpike Wind. They're a watershed company in southeastern Wisconsin, to start restoration efforts out on our cross-country course. These restoration efforts, they remove invasive species, they plant native flowers for pollinators, and they like open up gaps in canopy to try and recruit early spring flowers. But where we really come into this research is we monitor all of the restoration efforts that they're doing out there. So all of the restoration has been broken up into what we refer to as restoration phases. And there are currently 5 of those phases out on the cross-country course. And those phases all vary in level of restoration. So some of them are completely restored. Some of them are like still in the works of being restored, and others haven't had any work done on them at all yet. And just really the goal of that restoration is to enhance pollinator habitat and just promote residency out on the cross-country course. And the way that we monitor those phases is we go out and we'll do field surveys out in those phases where we record things such as the time of day, what restoration phase we're in, what the weather is like. We'll record how many bumblebees we see. And we also attempt to photograph as many of the bumblebees that we see so that later on when we're done with those surveys, we can attempt to make like definitive identifications of what species of bumblebee we're seeing out there.
How many species do we have? I'm sorry.
Oh, gosh, there's so many. I know, like, just in this most recent field season, I think we saw about probably 12 to 15 species out there. I don't have the exact number, but we've seen quite a few.
Okay. Yeah. And what degrades a habitat?
So mostly what is degraded habitats is, like what I said, like having invasive species there, just things that pollinators don't really like. And then also lots of our activities too, like maybe just like in Wisconsin, like salting roads and having that run off into water, into fields, into any of that. Yeah.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah. And is there any problem with the runners? It's on a cross-country course.
They have complained a bit about saying Like, they see so many bees out there, but I don't really think that has anything to do with us because they don't bother me when I'm out there. They're really docile creatures. They're not mean at all. I can get right up in their faces and take pictures of them. So they're, okay. Yeah, they're fine.
So I know you have a lot to say, and unfortunately we're on a tight time frame here. We might be able to come back to you near the end. If there's one more thing you want to say or a punchline you want to give us about what everybody should know about this effort, that would be a great way to wrap this up.
Yeah. If there really has been a true takeaway from this, it just has been that, like in our first year that we did this, we didn't see any of the endangered bumblebee species that we were hoping to see, which was really, it almost made it feel like a failure, but it absolutely wasn't because we got a great baseline of data to really understand what bees were out there. And then actually in our most recent field season, we did see several of the endangered rusty patch bumblebees. So we do know that they're out on the cross country course and that they are, I guess just that they're there. And then, just really that all of this restoration effort, aims to guide further, you might have to edit that out. I lost my spot. and just that this, all of our like work to monitor these populations just really aims to aid further restoration work, just both on and off campus.
Fantastic. Boy, that's a lot of information in a very short period of time. Fantastic. Yeah. Abby, I feel like my head is buzzing itself with all that information.
Yeah.
We'll hopefully be able to come back to this. Okay, let's move right along then with Caleb Neal of Pleasant Prairie, Wisconsin, UW Parkside student whose study was titled Walk This Way or That Way, Analyzing Shoulder Range of Motion in the Dinosaur Protohadros, I hope I pronounced that correctly, and its implications for motility. So hello, Caleb.
Hi, so I'm Caleb Neal, and a little bit about me. So I graduated from Parkside in the fall, and I just was continuing this research now into the spring here. But I actually was recently accepted at UW-Madison's PA program, which is physician assistant for anyone who doesn't know. And I'll be starting there in May.
Awesome.
But anyway, so yeah, like you said, my research surrounds, and you got it right, Protohadros birdi is the specific species name. And now that is a dinosaur, if no one's aware or you couldn't guess. That is an organism that was found 98 million years ago and was excavated in Arlington, Texas at the Arlington Archosaur dig site. Hmm. So being a dinosaur and trying to measure the range of motion and the motility of a shoulder joint, you run into a few problems right away. One of which being that all you're looking at are bones. And if you look at your own shoulder, you've got lots of soft tissue, including the skin, the muscle, and especially the cartilage, which the cartilage makes up a pretty significant portion of our own and every other organism's both length of the bone and the surface and the morphology, right. Which previously wasn't really, when you're looking at range of motion studies in other paleontology work, that was kind of either considered slightly or wasn't a major focus of the range of motion, and it was instead just looking at bone to bone, because that's some way that you can measure without having to do any extra work of reconstructing. However, so my research instead decided to we used some of the resources we had available at Parkside, which was a Nile crocodile and a caiman, which a caiman is a closely related species to the crocodile that's from South America, and courtesy of Dr. Meyer, we were able to get our hands on a couple of those.
Wow.
We went ahead and dissected out the shoulder joints of those two organisms and took measurements of the cartilage content that was on both the humeral head and within the glenoid, which is the surface made up by the coracoid and the scapula, which a lot of big words I'm throwing out there. But when you put it all together, we took those cartilage values and we applied them to 3D models that we had taken of Protohadros birdi's dinosaur bones.
Oh.
And you might ask, why did we do that? Well, the purpose of taking crocodile and caiman cartilage values and applying it to Protohadros is that there are no cartilage values of Protohadros or any other dinosaur, because cartilage deteriorates during the fossilization process. So to account for this, we took values of an adult, a subadult, and a juvenile specimen. So the caiman was the juvenile, the Nile crocodile was the subadult. And we applied those because we, based off the fossils that we do have, we're not able to identify if they are in an, if they were fossilized in an adult stage or in a subadult or a juvenile stage. And so to account for that, we added, and if you don't already know, little kids have more cartilage content than an adult does. So to account for that, we did three different versions. So anyways, after we applied all that in our 3D models, we used another resource that we had at Parkside, which is the 3D printer, courtesy of Dr. Noto, who is the professor who I did all this research underneath.
Fantastic.
And so the after 3D printing out three different sizes of bones and doing a whole bunch of measurements that took way longer than you'd imagine it would, we were able to come up with some values that demonstrated that not only does having the cartilage significantly increase the range of motion, it also gave us the answer to the question that we were looking at originally, which was that what kind of motility or how did it walk? Right. So this way or that. And the difference was, it did it walk as its ancestors did in a more sprawled posture, think more like the alligator, or was it more upright like its later descendants, the hadrosaurs? Because if you think proto-hadros, that name gives you the sense that it is the prototype to the hadrosaur, as in it is the ancestor of the hadrosaur lineage. Mm-hmm. And we were trying to determine, was it more upright, like a horse and like the later hadrosaurs, or sprawled? And we determined that it is, in fact, more sprawled in its posture, so still more akin to its ancestors. However, it was significantly more upright than Iguanodon, which is one of the common ancestors of this lineage that was more so sprawled like an alligator. And instead, it kind of operates in this middling position where its arms are slightly raised up off the ground, but is not quite fully underneath it like you would imagine a later hadrosaur or like a horse for a more visual representation of that. And if you want a reason why that might be significant is, like I said, that was a dinosaur found 98 million years ago in Arlington, Texas. So you might wonder, why on what now is a big plains, that sort of a arid environment, right, of Arlington, Texas, if you've ever been there, why would an organism that looks more like a crocodile in terms of its sprawled posture, why would that prefer to live in that environment? And the answer is that actually 98 million years ago, there was a shallow sea going through the entire middle of the United States. And at the time, Arlington, Texas was actually a marshland environment. So it was more akin to the Florida Everglades than it is to the arid climate that we see there now. And that coincides with the sprawled posture because organisms like crocodiles that have that sprawled stance do better on the uneven environment of a marshland area and would not fare as well on a more arid landscape where you have more flat lands where you want to travel great distances. So this kind of places it along the evolutionary pathway where it's going from Iguanodon, where it's a very sprawled stance, to the hadrosaurs. And our hypothesis is that as the environments of Arlington, Texas slowly dried up and went from a marshland into a flat, arid environment, so too did the hadrosaur lineage change from being sprawled to where it was more advantageous on that wetland environment to slowly adapted to be on a flatlands where it would operate more like a horse and be able to travel great distances to find food.
Okay. I'm sure there's more to be said about this, but unfortunately we're on a tight time schedule. But Caleb, that was really fascinating. And I can picture you as a physician's assistant talking to your clients about their cartilage and range of motion.
Right.
It's just a few steps away, right? So thank you. Our third student presenter is Elise Zevitz of Mount Pleasant, Wisconsin, UW-Parkside student, who is going to pronounce the title of her presentation for us.
Hi, Dr. Shaler. Hi. Thank you so much for having me on your program. Okay, so the first question is how to pronounce our title. So we are doing microwave-assisted synthesis of fluorescent 8-aryl 7-diazoguanine is our title this year.
Okay, tell us a little bit about yourself and about this study. And I think you also presented last year, so if you could give us a little on that as well.
Yeah, so I am a third-year post-baccalaureate pre-med student here at UW-Parkside, and I decided to go back to school after my original degree in history and classical studies. So I kind of made a 180 in my career and decided I wanted to go back to school to become a doctor.
Wow.
So that is my background, and I started getting involved in the organic chemistry research lab of Dr. Illyrian Dimitruka in the chemistry department on campus, and I've been working in his lab for the last 2 years.
Wonderful. And this study on that you did presented this year on the microwave-assisted synthesis of fluorescent, et cetera.
7-DGs, yeah.
Thank you.
So what's that about? That project is very much a bridge between organic chemistry and biochemistry, and which are both classes that I've been taking at Parkside. And with our, and we call them 7-DGs for short, because nobody wants to say the entire name of the molecule over and over again. Our 7-DG project looked at taking, the 7-DGs are nucleotide analogs. So nucleotides, for those who didn't go through Dr. Higgs's classes and so forth, or bio classes, nucleotides are the molecular building blocks of DNA. And in order to study the function of these components of our DNA, we scientists have to couple them with compounds that will fluoresce or glow. And similar to the function of when you use fluorescent or contrast dye, if you've ever gotten an MRI or a CT scan. So that's on a very large scale, but on a very small scale, we were looking at how to design nucleotide analogs that fluoresce, that have natural fluorescent properties based on their chemistry, based on their structures. So our professor in the lab had synthesized a class of nucleotide analogs called 7-DGs. We call them 8-aryl 7-diazoguanines, or 7-DGs for short. And the way he would synthesize these molecules would take him 24 to 96 hours of, it's called reflux. So basically you're cooking it in a beaker for that amount of time. And that's very time consuming, and also not very green as well, because you're using a lot of solvent and a lot of energy. And these aren't very green processes. So our objective in this project was to adapt this synthesis to a microwave. And it doesn't look like a microwave you have at home, but our microwave reactor at UW-Parkside functions in a very similar manner. It allows us to reduce the reaction time from something like 24 to 96 hours to a much shorter duration, and to be able to use less solvent. And these green solvents, like we were using dioxane, we don't want to have a lot of these solvents floating around and have to dispose of them. So that was our goal, was to be able to develop a process for doing this reaction in a microwave.
I see. I'm going to pause for just a moment for station identification. This is WGTD Radio. You're listening to Education Matters with your host, Jonathan Shaler, Professor David Higgs, and three students from UW-Parkside who presented at this year's Research in the Rotunda at the state capitol. We're now speaking with Elise Zevitz of Mount Pleasant, Wisconsin, about her research. She just told us about what she presented this year. She also presented last year something very interesting. If Elise, you could tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so last year, we have an ongoing project, actually. So we'll be continuing this project in the summer, but it was our Sunscreens from Natural Products project. So in the U.S. today, we have a limited number of UV filters for our sunscreens. And almost everyone I know uses sunscreen in one form or another, but what a lot of people don't realize is that the filters, the actual active ingredients in our sunscreens, are not very biodegradable, and they even may cause endocrine disruption. It's not very healthy for humans, and it also, they don't very easily biodegrade. And when we think about the environments in which we use sunscreens in, you know, often our lakes, our rivers, our oceans, these things matter, and these compounds don't easily degrade. And so our goal was to look at greener options, greener compounds for UV sunscreen filters. And we were focused on a particular class of compounds found in plants called hydroxycinnamic acid esters. So it's a really exciting project because one of our compounds called ferulic acid, which we use in microwave to synthesize ethyl ferulate, one of our filters, it's found in high commodities in corn, and corn brand specifically. And as a citizen of Wisconsin, and we're known for our corn, corn bran is a byproduct of the milling process. So if we can add value to something that doesn't currently have a whole lot of value, if we can extract our starting materials for sunscreens and create a more green alternative for some of our filters, it's kind of an exciting direction, and something that I feel like people from Wisconsin especially can relate to.
Oh, yes. Fantastic. Wow. Both of those projects are just kind of mind-boggling. There's so much to consider in what you've just shared with us. When I think about the use of fluorescence in studying DNA material, I think of what great value that has for so many strains of research that come out of the examination of DNA, obviously, and that finding a more efficient process has implications, as you said, for the environment, less use of energy and less use of toxic materials. And then the sunscreen study, was my shorthand for that one, is also very exciting. Then the practical applications are obvious and wonderful. So maybe we could just have a thank you, Elise. Maybe we could all now just have a chat about what that experience at the Capitol was like, what kinds of conversations you had, either with the governor or a legislator or a fellow researcher from another campus. You know, what does it mean to have participated in this? Any thoughts?
Go ahead, Caleb.
Oh, okay. Sorry, with the video call, it's hard to tell. But one thing that really stood out to me was I believe they were from Platteville, but I had a professor who also does paleontology research at Platteville come up to me, and he was similarly doing research surrounding joint mobility and motion. And he thought it was really interesting how we elected to use a 3D printer to make a physical construction, because we physically printed out our digital models and turned them into real-life models. And he thought that that was very interesting and decided that moment that he was going to go home and buy a 3D printer. So that way he tested it out and see if he liked that method for his own research.
Oh, that's awesome. I'd like to see a movie of that dinosaur. sell your data to Steven Spielberg or somebody.
Right? One day.
Yeah.
Would that be Jurassic Park, Parkside?
That's what I was thinking, yeah. But Caleb, that's wonderful. It's an example of, you know, when researchers get together, the unexpected connections that can be made and progress that can be achieved. That's wonderful. Any other interesting interactions or what it was like to meet? Yeah.
I think for me, when I say that the experience can be filled with a lot of nerves, even my second year presenting at the Rotunda, I remember being filled with so many nerves because you're so anxious to present about topics that you spend so much time on and topics that you're truly passionate about, and you really just want to make your research heard. But then walking into the Rotunda and being surrounded by probably hundreds of other undergraduate researchers, you sort of begin to understand that they feel exactly the same way that you do. and all of those nerves just kind of settle and you get calm, and it's just really relieving to be able to talk about your research and just your topics to people who understand where you're coming from, who are in the same shoes as you, and they've just had similar experiences. So it's really nice to make your research heard to people who are so similar to you.
Sure, that makes a lot of sense, Abby. And I imagine you heard some interesting presentations while you were there.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Elise?
I always enjoy walking around and learning something new about a discipline that I like even the shoulder, the motion of a shoulder joint of a dinosaur that lived 98 million years ago. It's so different from the molecular level that we're working on. And I think I enjoy the Rotunda event immensely, because I think it's a bit of a challenge where we're so focused on and doing our research the whole year and being able to communicate with our professors. But then when we take it to the Rotunda, gosh, our audiences, I always ask when people come to our poster, you know, what's your background? You know, I was in history. So, and I like to understand where they're coming from, especially with our reps and our senators and, you know, what's your background? Or have you ever taken a chemistry class? Because it's a fun challenge to be able to serve as an ambassador to what we're studying, but and make it meaningful for people on different levels. And with sunscreens, for example, I'm like, have you used a sunscreen? Have you not used a sunscreen? And, you know, people can relate to that. And I think when you can connect with people and share the meaning of what we're doing, I think that makes the experience, it enriches the experience for me as a student, for sure.
Did anybody plug you for recommendations on specific sunscreens?
I've had people ask me, okay, so what's your favorite one? And, or, you know, which ones are you using? And I'm like, we're not using any of these right now. We're in a very, very early stage. So I would not recommend, you know, experimenting with your own sunscreens quite yet.
You're not a media influencer here. You know.
Oh, no, no, not at all. But it's been fun. I mean, we've had some great discussions with people from all different backgrounds about their own experiences, you know, whether it's with sunscreens or whether it's with MRIs or fluorescence, or it's, you never know.
And as somebody who's a social scientist and somebody in the humanities, I'm a communication professor, I'm curious about the range of disciplines represented at the Rotunda. I assume mostly STEM fields, if not exclusively, although I think Parkside had one presentation that was more of a sociological study?
Yeah, Jonathan, I think that's a really important question. And frankly, one we kind of struggle with is not just Parkside, but it's all of these kind of events, be it the research in the Rotunda or the National Council on Undergrad Research. The structure, the poster format, that kind of fits in the culture of the sciences. And I know social sciences is a science as well. And the creative arts, the creative scholarship, be it, you know, the music and the English and the writing, the poetry, theater, et cetera. I mean, there's just different cultures. And so sometimes this venue doesn't always work as well. But we make a concerted effort just to kind of give a brief perspective. What we do on our campus is we put a call for submissions for titles and abstracts campus-wide. And then usually around November, end of November, we kind of go through those. And we're only allowed 6 spots, so we kind of have to narrow it down. But we make a concerted effort to try to represent as many of the colleges and the disciplines as we can. And we also try to make sure it's not just all coming from, you know, one particular area. Mm-hmm. To, frankly, represent as broadly as we can. And we have had students from the theater. We've had students from communications, your home department, that have presented at times, and it works really well. In some ways, visually, sometimes it works almost better because as you kind of saw from all 3 of these students that did an outstanding job, when you drill down to the details, sometimes it's easy to get lost in the minutia. But all of these, particularly the 3 just discussed it, had big impacts. You know, the way people move, cartilage and bone. Bees, huge, important in our ecosystems and our food production. Sunscreens, you know, I'm a child of the 70s where a sunburn was a badge of honor. Not so healthy now.
Oh.
So the impacts are huge, but the minutiae, sometimes it's easy to get swamped in. And therefore, sometimes the art, sometimes they're almost easier to present the impact. But it's an area that all of us wish there was a little more better ways, perhaps, to involve the creative arts, the scholarship from the creative arts. Mm. So I think it's a really important question you raised.
Yeah, very interesting. Maybe people will start thinking about that and possibly alternative forms of presentation. I know that videos are recorded and uploaded to the website, and that's one way that people can participate.
Yeah, the videos are an option. They encourage students to do that. Some don't. I think, I'm pretty sure Elise, your group did videos. Did Caleb or Abby, did either of your groups do a video, like a short video?
No, I didn't do a video. It was just me.
My group didn't do a video either, no.
Maybe we'll put a link to Elise's video because I watched it and it was really well produced.
Thank you. Well, yeah. We had a lot of help with us. I wanted to do a video to be able to show people that weren't able to attend the Rotunda about our project and actually how we do what we do in the lab, because a poster is very one-dimensional or two-dimensional, but it doesn't actually show what it looks like to produce sunscreens with these filters. So our video was our way to sort of bridge that divide, and we had a lot of fun at Parkside. We had some help from Steven Schlecht in Innovations, who helped us with a green screen and some of the post-production. We had a ball making that video, and so I would love to share it with others.
Cool. Yeah, it's super professional. Loved it. Okay, we have about 2 minutes. Is there anything else anybody would like to share, thoughts that have come up during today's discussion?
I just want to say, besides a thank you for having us on your program, the experience of undergrad research at Parkside has really made the my time there what it very meaningful and what it was. And I don't think we would be where we are today without the faculty, the mentorship, and all the time that we've spent, you know, outside of our classes in the lab, hands-on doing these things that we've done. And I would also encourage non-traditional students, adult students who are considering going back to school, to absolutely do it. Like, it's scary. We're busy, but if you have the time, even take one class. It's so worth it. And I highly recommend it.
What a great recommendation. Thank you. Anyone else?
I wanted to say that, like I had said before, I'm going to PA school. Not super closely related to paleontology when you look at it on paper. But I would really, similar to Elise, I would encourage students to look for opportunities to do research, even in fields that you wouldn't quite think are going to be the most relevant. Because as a pre-PA student, looking at when I was offered to do paleontology research, at first I was kind of taken aback, but then when I thought about it, paleontology, like Dr. Higgs alluded to, you're studying the range of motion of, yes, a dinosaur, but learning about the way that an organism that's very different from your own moves has major implications on learning not only how the human body might work, but, go ahead.
I'm sorry, but we're out of time. I just want to thank all of you. Caleb Neal, who's just speaking, Abby Lentz and Elise Zevitz, and Professor David Higgs, their coordinator from the University of Wisconsin Parkside, who presented at the Research in the Rotunda this year at March 6th at the Capitol in Madison. I want to thank you so much for sharing your research with us today and the exciting possibilities that lie in the future. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Bye.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard Saturday mornings at 10:30 here on WGTD. Archive programs are available on our website at WGTD.org.
I'm Gregory Berg. The studios of WGTD will be closed on Monday because of the holidays, so there will be no morning show broadcast. But there will be a morning show podcast for you to enjoy. In fact, when you subscribe to the morning show podcast, you can hear a different morning show 7 days a week and 365 days a year through Spotify, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. To subscribe, look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg.
Well, this week on WGTD's Noon Tunes, we welcome back Milwaukee-based pianist Tim Clawson. At the end of every WGTD midday newscast, we feature a song by a local artist, so come on and join us for Noon Tunes Monday through Friday, 12:20 p.m. here on WGTD HD.